discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed?
Now, did we decide earlier that we were going to incorporate the receiving definition in the definitions back here?
Yes.
So, and I think we all agreed, so there's no need for a specific motion on that. We go next on page 14, the right of possession.
What?
Unless somebody has any other problems.
Yeah, we better bring up something about that, I think that we've chalked this up to the gremlins or something, but we've got a duplication here in this draft. We've got provisions appearing in two places.
Correct.
Rights of possession also appear over on page 2. 4A and B. 4A and B and C contain the same provisions that we had in 7. Now, we've picked those up from two separate drafts, apparently, when we consolidated into draft number 4.
We don't need section 7.
No.
Are you going to have a commentary, or is that duplicated also?
Truly definitions, or should be...
I think that the intent of the subcommittee, my recollection is that we were to leave this under section 7, wasn't that?
That's where I think so. Page 11.
I think that should remain in 7, and should be removed from page 2. 4, A, B, and C should come out.
That's from earlier draft, I think, that we picked up to get property back.
Yeah.
You're reading 4, A, B, and C on page 2?
No, we need 4.
Delete 4.
But, I mean, you need 4.
Delete 7.
Delete some of the subsections.
Delete all the subsections under 4.
Oh, I see.
And leave 7 as is.
Right.
That's right.
What's that?
That's easy. Now let's go back and argue with the subsection.
Let's go back and argue with which Steve has got the honor.
4, A, B, C, and C are deleted because they appear in section 7.
Section 4.
But section 4 itself stands. We went over this. We went over these earlier.
I'm going to go back and read Don's commentary and see if he commented the same way on both of
them. As far as consistent.
All right. Mr. Chairman, then we go to section 8 on page 16. And the discussion on this appears on the minutes of March 23rd and page 9, and there's nearly a page of it. I hesitate whether it's necessary to read those things. Why don't we read it to ourselves, and if there's any questions, raise them. As the minutes point out, the Model Penal Code said the highest value by any reasonable standard. We thought that we ought to use the market value of the property at the time and place of the crime rather than going to the Model Penal Code.
Why did the Model Penal Code pick the language that they did?
There's a commentary on that, and Don Collette can read it to us. I don't recall quite it yet. The Do you recall, Don, why they use the highest value by any reasonable standard as a criterion?
Would that relate to the credit card problem discussed or considered at this point?
We're going to get into a separate section on credit cards.
You want to know why the Model Penal Code uses that language?
Yeah. We didn't follow their language.
No, we didn't. No, we followed the language of the New York. And mainly we followed it because it goes into more detail as to how to determine the value of the property. And we felt that it might be more explicit, particularly in the area of negotiable instruments.
And all of those used language satisfactorily ascertained, and we struck that to use the expression reasonably to ascertain, so that we can employ a reasonable standard.
This wouldn't make any change, I take it, in the manner in which you establish the value.
No.
The owner can testify, and that's
right. I
guess it's been a troublesome problem.
Yeah. Well, as I understand it now, you have a case, and there's not a market for the, there's not a market value of the item. The owner testifies to its replacement cost, and this is the standard that you use. This isn't in any statute, but we're putting it in the statute. So it doesn't change, no.
I'll see if I can find the commentary from the Model Penal Code on their particular language.
Then we say, I think maybe we change it with regard to sub 2. Whether they've been issued or delivered, certain written instruments, not including those having a readily ascertainable market value, shall be evaluated as follows. The value of an instrument constituting an evidence including but not limited to a check, draft, promissory note, shall be deemed the amount due or collectible thereon or thereby. And B, value of any other instrument which creates, releases, discharges, or otherwise affects any valuable legal right, privilege, or obligation shall be deemed the greatest amount of economic loss which the owner might reasonably suffer because of the loss of the instrument. So probably this does change. And then we say, finally, that when the value can't reasonably be ascertained, it is presumed to be an amount of less than $100. Section 3, sub 3 is an important section there, and actually the subcommittee didn't have any disagreement with respect to this after we cleared up the technical language, substituting reasonably for satisfactorily, and it was our feeling that we pretty much followed the existing law on it. What we're doing is making a statutory now.
Is there magic in the $100 figure as opposed to $75 or $150? Or what were the considerations that motivated the subcommittee?
Well, there's not any magic in it. We're going to have a policy decision to make a little bit later on. How we're going to define classes, misdemeanors, whether we're going to have a class A, B, and C felonies, class A, B, and C misdemeanors. And I suppose this would be subject to change when the Building Commission makes a determination there. We just used $100 here.
Sounds like a nice round
number. out and figure out.
May I interrupt and ask a general problem question that has occurred to us as we're working on our assigned articles down in Oregon? Students raised the question to me on the penalties, and this is what we're really talking about here. I advise them not to concern themselves with any penalty provisions at all, but this would be inserted later when these decisions are made. I assume that Mr. Collette would then have to go back to all these sections and insert whatever penalty provision is necessary. Is that correct?
Yeah, in fact, I mentioned that in one section here of the commentary that we have not included any penalty provisions. The early drafts, we did have penalty provisions.
Well,
we had A, B, and C
types. Throughout the states, Illinois, for instance, puts its penalties in specifically without regard to any other general collection as the Model Penal Code has later. But at any rate, we will not concern ourselves with that while we're doing our part of this work.
No,
that's for
later. Because the classes of crimes are going to have to be decided by the commission.
Well,
they're going to apply throughout.
It certainly seems to me that on the $100 that on that, there's no point in making a decision on it now. We ought to wait until we get into the other area, and then we can just come back and decide on this one.
If you're going to redo this, if you're going to retype this to incorporate some other changes, would it be the consensus of the commission that we amount less than blank?
Yeah, that
right?
Yeah.
You can leave it blank.
All right.
We shouldn't call attention to it anyway.
Subsection 3, we really need the word reasonably. Why can't we delete it?
I wonder how what practical effect this is going to have. I'm thinking in terms of let us say you prosecute for theft of an old car, let's say. You want to know whether whether or not it's a felony or misdemeanor or some other classification we end up with. And you have some testimony that says it is and some that says it isn't. This is just a matter of instruction or motion. How would it?
It's a matter for an instruction for your general instruction on reasonableness. The jury is to determine to be charged that they have the responsibility of applying the reasonable man standard to that.
Would you have a special verdict for it? You find the defendant guilty, and you further find that the value of the property in question is blank dollars.
Three for blank, I think.
I think you got some problems there.
Mr. Martin, you raised the question about the reasonably, but what's your thought?
I just wondered if it was necessary in there. All of this is subsection as far as to take care of the contingency where there is no proof available as to the value of the article. Now, what the sole purpose of this thing is?
Well,
why do you need reasonably in there? It can be ascertained.
He had satisfactorily before they removed it in the subcommittee. What the distinction is between the two?
Well,
satisfactorily was the language used in the New York draft, and the subcommittee felt it. Reasonably would be better word than satisfactory.
I think satisfactory is all right, but I don't see why you need it.
I think your point's well taken, and probably we don't need it either reasonably or.
Well, let us say.
In fact, maybe we don't need this.
We have an actual case, and this would happen. We have an actual case, and for one reason or another, there's no proof at all of that. And let's say the article is suitcase, which might or might not be worth more than $100. And there's no evidence at all. Well, presumably it'd be worth less than $100 under this section, and therefore, if he was guilty of stealing it, it'd be a misdemeanor.
some value, wouldn't it, to have a due process?
That's what I'm wondering, is if there is any evidence of that, is it a crime?
They go back to property, don't you?
Yeah, one, there's something back.
Well, we've got a definition of...
Well, it says that one of the previous sections says a item or a substance or something of value, so it...
It's article, substance, or thing of value.
Article, substance, or thing.
So it doesn't have to have any value, does it?
You steal a suitcase, that's a crime.
Steal a feather.
Why do we need the whole section, strike the section? One section.
I think there's a value in the section. That, presuming that this is a question that's gonna be decided by a jury and a special verdict, but it's gonna keep somebody from spanking somebody unnecessarily. But it's running away with something. Your addiction to hell down here, too.
Well, our present, reference to value in the Oregon Code is in the Larson section. Any person who steals a property of another, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, is guilty of larceny. And, A, if the property exceeds $75 in value, felony. B, if it doesn't exceed $75 in value, it's misdemeanor. Now, that's the only reference in the general larceny section to value. I know of cases where the district attorney has failed to prove value, and the court has found that all the elements weren't proven, and then a motion for a direct verdict or a judgment of acquittal was well taken. If we retain this section here, I spoke of three, I suppose, is susceptible to two interpretations. One, if the DA neglects to prove value, judge would instruct on whatever class of theft that is, misdemeanor, whatever, petty.
District attorney failed to prove it. I don't see how the judge could supply that.
Well, it's susceptible of one of two interpretations. That or motion for direct verdict, period.
Couldn't the judge just remove this element, though, from consideration by the jury? His instructions. Say if you have an indictment for grand larceny, and one of the allegations of the indictment was that this property was of a value of more than $75. And there was no proof on it. Or the testimony came in, the owner got up and said that property was worth $74.95.
Well, what you do there as a practical matter now is you instruct the lesser included
right.
And you direct the verdict on the greater offense.
But the jury could still find him guilty of petty larceny.
Yeah, there's a proof of that.
Well, there's no proof.
Well, it's my impression, I'm just trying to think back on a number of these credit card cases, I'm not at all sure they have to prove value. To show that if you went into Fred Meyer with the person's credit card and got a bunch of shirts or whatever it was.
We're going to have to draft a specific section on credit cards.
Oh, yeah.
What we're trying to do here, isn't going to apply to credit cards. But I'm hung up on this. I don't know what to say about it.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm moving past this temporarily.
Yeah, we'll adopt it sometime.
That's no more.
Yeah, we're not so pretty.
Yeah,
that's not as coming
to grips with the issue.
Well, I think for now, I'm just
going
to leave it in anyway.
Jim and I are
going to
walk
out.
No, I think
I need it. I see his admiration.
The last one is section 9. This is something new.
I think it's needed. I would like to ask a general question. Is this an affirmative defense?
Well, it says the defendant has the burden of objecting the issue in the case, bringing the subject up.
Doesn't mean he has to plead it, though. That's what he means.
Oh, no, it isn't intended to object.
No, that's what I mean. That's what he means by an affirmative defense.
Generally speaking, affirmative defenses in criminal cases need not be negated by the prosecution, but on the other hand, they don't really shift the burden of proof in the sense of the burden of persuasion. But when it comes to insanity, that does shift the burden of proof. The defendant has the burden of proving the amount by a preponderance in the present tense.
More than just a question, that's it. Continue to run into a how you instruct the alibi and the trap and that sort of thing. Should you realize Jordan from all the cases that come up with? Continue the problem.
Yeah. Well, what we were trying to state here was that we want to make it clear that this is a defense, or these things would amount to defenses to a charge of theft. But they're not elements to be negatived by the prosecution. And when he pleads, when he indicts somebody for theft, that he doesn't have to allege that the defendant was unaware that it was the, or that the defendant was aware that it was the property of another, or that the defendant did not reasonably believe that he was entitled to the property. That's why we use the language, the burden of injecting the issue was on the defendant, that this would have to be brought up during the course of the trial by the defendant.
But not pleaded by the defendant as you specially plead the affirmative defense in Saturday, right?
Right.
Now, I'm satisfied that that's appropriate legislative history to make of. The term injecting the issue is an interesting term.
It's our drug conscious age.
Is that on the mainline
image? Now that particular language we stole from the Michigan draft.
It's far too easy to understand, just to me.
Judge, you're suggesting going forward with the evidence, producing evidence or introducing evidence, something like that.
The famous definition of opening statement is to get in all the evidence that you know you can't get in
right
in
the trial.
Sure that in your actual case, take for example your entrapment situation or your alibi situation, if there's no evidence at all on alibi that comes in anywhere, you don't have to instruct an alibi. He requests alibi instruction, you refuse it. Same thing on entrapment, but the question of injecting the claim, I just don't know.
Well, I wonder if something maybe was intended to get at is that it is not necessary for the prosecution to negative these defenses in indictment or in their proof. And if the statement would be a general statement that the defenses enumerated in section 9 do not require, do not need to be negative in the indictment or evidence of the state, or words to that effect.
Well, wouldn't the commentary on page 18 under A, where you're talking about subsection 2, would it be cleared up if we expand that by saying this does not require the prosecution to negative pleading or proof period, this is not required the defendant to give notice or to plead.
What I said, you can put a comment on that, but I am concerned about, Jim is concerned about the use of the word objective. The defendant doesn't come on any evidence to interview, but he presents request instructions on one of these subjects. Is this injecting the issue where you feel like you're compelled to give instructions on it? Even though there isn't any evidence on the subject.
Well, I think the comment summary here is more to the point. It says produce evidence.
Now, I would think so. Well, just asking for an instruction wouldn't, in my opinion, my poor, uneducated opinion, mean injecting the issue into the trial. That's just something to give the judge to keep in the office until he gets all through with it.
Well, take for example, instruction on alibi. We have a standard bar instruction on alibi, which says, in effect, that alibi is a claim the defendant is not present at the time and place when the crime is committed. And then it goes on to say about if you have a reasonable doubt that the defendant is present, why you should acquit it. The burden is still on the prosecution to prove that he was there at the time and place in question, which is implicit in your elements of the crime. But so the fact that the defendant brings in alibi doesn't shift the burden. The prosecution still has to prove he was there at the time and place in question. They have to prove it beyond reasonable doubt, and so on. I take it the same result would obtain here. Let's say, for example, he contends that he was unaware that the property was that of another. Now, he raises that issue, he injects the issue, and puts on some evidence. But the state still has to prove that he stole the property. Sure, your instructions would still have to cover that, somewhat similar to what they do in the alibi case, huh?
So, your instruction, in the example you cite, the defendant doesn't take the stand. He submits an instruction relating to one of these defenses. He wouldn't be entitled to that instruction because he didn't produce any evidence
at the trial. Well, other than to say that if the state fails to meet the burden of proving that I was, that the defendant was unaware that the property is another.
Well, the state doesn't have any burden.
Yes, it does.
Well,
the state still has to prove all the elements to the charge beyond reasonable doubt.
He has to. One of the elements is he has to have the intent to deprive another of the property. Now, how can he have that intent if he's honestly, if he's unaware that the property is that of another?
I see the derivation of this and so on, but I'm wondering about the necessity of this section.
On defenses?
No, yes, why do we need this?
Well, the example that Senator Mahoney raised earlier with respect to specified deception and the question he raised and the answer I gave by way of citing 1B is one reason why we need it. In other words, if we're going to broaden criminal liability to the point that we have, I think in theft by extortion, theft by deception, and so on, we have to have some set of safeguards to which the prosecutor can look in the exercise of his discretion to whom the, or to which the court can look in passing on these things, to whom the attorneys can look. I think that you've just got to have
draw our lines far more narrowly and be a lot more careful.
I have the same feeling that John does, that although many of these claim of right things of this sort would exist to fall back on the common law, that you insert them in to specific cases, that we are dealing with a new concept of that, and that we ought to regularize well-established common law and include these for the purposes that John has mentioned, where we are going beyond what the concept of larceny and all these other things were. I see advantages to having this, but I don't really see a lot of disadvantages.
I don't see any disadvantages either. I think from a political point, there needs to be some sort of a break on the borough discretion of the district attorney.
Mm-hmm. And what we were trying to do was to make this as comprehensive a draft as possible, and although this is just a codification of some existing common law principles, these common law principles apply to larceny. We're talking about theft.
We're talking about other things.
Mr. Chairman, that is a solid substance of what your subcommittee did.
May I ask the question, what were the opposing briefly the opposing views on subsection 5, which you have in your
Page 11, April.
That's where you're discussing having a meeting.
Yeah, well, that was a meeting we discussed.
That was a meeting before last, I think, where we voted to take that out.
We had a lively discussion.
It's near the end of the minutes.
Okay. Mr. Spalding noted that subsection 3 provided that a man couldn't steal from his wife and asked if this was inconsistent with the married woman statute. Professor Arthur commented that the decisions throughout the country have been to the effect that in spite of the married woman statutes, a man and his wife could not steal from each other. Mr. Collette indicated there is no Oregon authority on this point. Professor Arthur observed that the model penal code reporters have discussed the subject at great length and have proposed many different solutions to the problem, but it finally settled on the approach set forth in the draft under consideration, which changed the law slightly in the direction of allowing theft from a spouse to be larceny. Mr. Spalding objected to making the couple go to the divorce court in order to enforce their rights. Mr. Follett advised that subsection 3 was taken from the Illinois Code. It did not require the couple to be divorced, but did require them to be living apart. Expressed the view that it was a middle-of-the-road approach to the problem and that it provided protection for the spouse where needed, but wouldn't put the district attorney in an impossible situation. Mr. Spalding maintained that subsection 3 should be omitted from the draft, and I concurred, and Representative Elder favored retention of the provision. And then we decided by a vote of 2-1 that we should delete it. And it's only be to let the common law control in the situation. And theft wouldn't be expanded to include the theft of spouses. We agreed, however, that the full commission should be given an opportunity to discuss it. And so that's why we put it in brackets.
What kind of a problem is it? First, if we go common, if we just delete it, is this going to create any problems? How many times is a husband on his wife arrested for?
In my experience, when I was in the district court in Multnomah County authorizing all the complaints that came in, every day you'd have four or five women that would come in and want their husbands arrested for something. And the first time it happened, being young and naive, you'd authorize a complaint, and when it came up for trial,
like an assault battery.
So, just as a practical matter, you got callous. You say, don't, you know. And so one time a woman went out to Milwaukee and shot a thing and got shot by her husband six times. They said, see there, bird? I said, well, happy Silas County. But it isn't. In the biggest county in the state, it wasn't a problem.
It's once in a blue moon, some guy marries a gal, and then 6 weeks later he takes off and sends down a dime and runs out to Brazil.
They're all moving towards this, the model penal code, and all the states are moving toward it. And I think, really, because it's based on a fiction, this unity of husband and wife fiction. And it seemed to me that the Illinois approach was sort of a compromise. It gave some protection there, and if it was required, but it would keep all the property disputes out of the DA's office. Some of them would come up, but I don't feel that strongly about one another, but I felt that,
Let's not forget the League of Women Voters. We're talking about special interest groups here.
Well, I think the Domestic Relations Judge is a special interest group. He's lucky with it now, isn't he, all the time with his time.
Well, as a practical matter, if you had the section in there, I suspect that he would still refuse complaints, probably, even though the parties were living apart and so on and so forth. He'd still turn most of them down as a...
And being in there, it might provide a vehicle for the unlikely or the unusual case that would merit a prosecution.
In the district court in issuing complaints, I'm under the impression that it's mandatory. Is that correct? In misdemeanors? Statute, someone pointed that out to me the other day. Courtney, do you happen to be aware of that?
Yeah, I think it says shall. Of course, now you've got a problem because in Multnomah County, the district court is a court of equity, not a court of law. So there might be a different rule.
I don't want to my question. It's a matter of point of information for myself, I suppose.
Well, technically, I think technically you're right, but as a practical matter, if you do, the DA walks in behind and dismisses it. And again, in theory, the DA can't dismiss it because the judge has had to dismiss it. DA doesn't show up to prosecute, there's nothing you can do.
Of course, now, when this came up in Lane County just recently,
assault and battery between the students and the student that he got the hassle with.
And the DA refused to prosecute the complainant for whom the state had authorized the complaints originally. The defendant came in and wanted to complain against the original complainant. The student wanted to complain against this dean. What the court did was just appoint a special prosecutor, and the special prosecutor was the defendant's attorney.
Well, so, we have this Ralph Lemon situation in Multnomah County where he's always after the judges to issue a complaint. Because he's not getting
nothing.
He just sued Bill Day. Try him and then he gets sued.
But it seems to me, though, when we're talking about these spouses, that if these people are living apart and she's got her property and he's got his property, that for one or the other to go over there and steal the other's property with immunity, somehow it just seems repugnant to me.
I agree with you.
You might be opening up a Pandora's box and a horrible situation for the DAs. I don't know.
The DA's still got discretion.
He's still, that's true.
The skinny cases, he's still going to run them out the door. He's not going to automatically issue a complaint just because they're living apart.
Right.
I'm going to make a motion to
all right, I'll move for the back.
Second. We need section 7.
Well, I never voted to take it out.
I think it's unimportant, but I'm for it.
Question. All in favor?
wonder, one more interjection, is there any problem of equal protection with this? A man who's not living with his wife is in a different class, isn't he? And he's still married. Let's strike.
Class with the class.
You mean a fellow who's living with his wife?
Well, they're treated differently. They're treated differently. Uh-huh. Section, and yet they're still in the same marital relationship.
Well, I think it's a good classification, though, because there's the marriage has already something gone wrong with her, then separate apart.
Better to try to preserve a marriage. Wouldn't it be a reasonable classification because of the problems of ownership that they're living together?
Well, I suppose so.
Reasonable basis for classifying because of property rights, ownership rights.
One has a stroke, the other has a refrigerator.
All right, all, any further discussion? All in favor of putting it back in?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
Aye.
Consistently.
I thought you were getting along pretty well.
I couldn't vote against
that previous
story.
Well, I think that's
about
time. Now, Chairman, that covers what your subcommittee has done up to, well, we also have done some work on taking and using more vehicles. And we're going to get into that next. I would move then that subject to the amendments and subject to the amendments and the reservations that have been adopted at today, that we go on record as approving this preliminary draft. Now, the record should show that my motion doesn't bind this committee.
Approve it for circulation.
Right. We're not binding the committee to a ultimate adoption of this.
Or even the subcommittee.
We approve it for circulation.
So yeah. John, it would be redrafted as per the discussion and the motions today and it's circulated. Is that the idea?
Right.
Second.
Okay. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Okay.
You do good work.
May I read something to you from which I think you'll take heart. I'll explain it first by saying that the source of this is the section newsletter of the law section of the Illinois State Bar. I have obtained from the Illinois State Bar Association the back issues of their newsletters and their criminal law section since the adoption of the 1961 code, for obvious reasons, that these newsletters discuss in some detail the development of cases and procedures under that code, which I find are helpful in the work that we're doing. And I'd like to read one excerpt to you.
Okay.
Attorneys all over the state, on both sides of the table, are now struggling manfully with the new criminal code. The reports to date have been most favorable, and some anticipated difficulties have vanished upon actual application. Most state's attorneys are discovering that old concepts are easily replaced by new ones, that articulation of crimes is up to date precise phrasing and phraseology is actually a boon. Particularly in the theft field, many state's attorneys are finding it much easier to make facts fit the crime rather than in the good old days when there was a plethora of choices, with doubt always as to whether the right choice was made. So I think this is an indicative that the Illinois experience has been very good with its not only its theft statute but its new code.
I think the executive director ought to reproduce that and send it to every district attorney. Or
well, I think with permission of the committee, that it'd be well to insert that comment in minutes here for those who might be reading it too. I think that is a good point.
Now, as long as Professor Klein has the floor, perhaps before you adjourn, Mr. Chairman, we could have him give us the progress report that was on the agenda, just so that the commission members will know where the Oregon drafting team is. Their work right now.
I'll make it brief. The student project committee that is working on this material consists of six students. Five of them are first-year students, and one is a second-year student. They are all well above average, most of them in the A bracket range, and the other, a couple of them in the B range. They're very good students. I know them all personally. I've had them in my criminal law class. We have been assigned the articles on these bullet crimes, conspiracy, intent, and solicitation, the article on homicide, and the article on responsibility, which includes insanity and immaturity. We have been meeting regularly each week so that I can keep track of what they're doing and instill sort of a group project sense with them. We met Wednesday of this week, and the report of status now, in the on the responsibility article, the man in charge of the principal research there is at the point of preparing his comments. In other words, he is at the draft stage now, suggesting what the language ought to be with the supporting comments to explain the language. The homicide and inchoate crimes articles have not quite reached that stage, but will, within this week, be at that stage also. We have agreed among ourselves that it's not unreasonable to hope that by May 18th, the first rough draft of the entire project will be complete, which means, of course, it is not complete in any sense that it won't come to the commission at that time. At that time, the students will tend to phase out for a while because they'll be faced with finals about 2 weeks later, and I intend to move in more heavily at that point in checking their work and beginning the revision of the comments. I don't anticipate, I can't predict when the date will be that this material will reach the commission, but it certainly will be in very early summer, I assume in June. I would like to predict the competence of it, but I must confess that I won't be able to until I see the actual work product in written form that the students have produced. I am encouraged that by the attitude of the students, they are finding things that I was unaware of. They're asking the right kind of questions. They're looking at the right kind of material. The research was well structured for them. I talked this over with Don before we began the project so we could set out the areas that the students would know that they had to search and the sources they had to search. I'm hopeful that the job will prove to be competent, but again, one never knows about student work, so we won't know until we see it. But we are in good shape and making substantial progress.
Very good. My subcommittee's going to have something to do yet. Any other reports or comments? Don, do you have anything else?
No, I don't have anything else at this point. We'll go ahead and make the changes that have been recommended and circulate this further. I intend to go ahead and some of these other areas now, crimes against property, because although we're taking this in segments, eventually we hope to put it all together in a logical package as one section of dealing with crimes against property. And so we'll be seeing much more of the theft article before we're through. I would be interested in any comments any of you have about this, whether or not you think this is going to be a feasible method of proceeding here with the commission work. If you feel that this subcommittee approach, from what we've seen of it here today and what you've seen of it so far, it is a reasonable and workable one.
I think it would be great. Right. Mm-hmm. After all, nitpicking
is getting something to make that general. Justice Long, do you have any comments?
No.
Professor Archer.
I think it's working out.
Right. I think this is the approach. The only thing that I'd like to hear a little more about maybe next meeting is why we're departing from the model code in some respects, or why we're picking and choosing between one and the other, and why we're, even when we follow one, we change the wording some. I think we should think about this more. There's nothing else. Well, then I guess Don, the chairman, will call next meeting.
And I think we should dispense with reading in the minutes. I assume you've all looked them over, and are there any corrections or additions to the minutes? Okay. If not, then do we have a motion to approve them?
Okay.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Okay, now, as you know, the draft that we approved at the April 6th meeting was submitted to the full commission at its April 27th meeting, and the full commission tentatively adopted our draft practically in total. There were two or three corrections that or amendments that were made, and it's my understanding that you corrected or amended preliminary draft number 4, and that's being ready for distribution. Is that right?
Oh yes, yeah. We're expanding some of the commentary and, of course, making the amendments to reflect the suggestions made at the full commission meeting, and that will be redistributed as amended.
Okay. Then the chairman has given us the go-ahead with regard to the related areas of the criminal law, or the areas related to the consolidated theft statute, and since we've been doing so well, I thought that we better just continue. Don has prepared a preliminary draft number 1, which has been distributed for today's meeting. Bruce and Ed get copies of that. I didn't. I didn't either. But that's all right. I think what we'll do is we'll go right into that, and I'm just going to turn it over to Don. Before I do, I want to ask a question. Are services presently defined anywhere in the criminal code?
In our existence.
Yes, in our existence. And is there no current theft of services statute other than the defrauding innkeeper section?
Well, I've set out on page 3 of this draft, set out statutes that deal either with theft of services or with illegal interference in the utilities area. That's the type of thing. We have defrauding the stable keeper, for example. That's one of the statutes that is a theft of services type of statute.
So your draft here is designed to comprehensively cover all these sections that are enumerated on page 3, plus going beyond, is that right?
Well, yes, and then, of course, there's a related section here, which is called criminal tampering, which is designed to pick up the interference type of conduct that would not be covered under the theft of services draft.
Okay. I'm going to turn it over to you. I'm wondering if, before I do any members or anyone present have any questions or want to raise anything at the outset? That we've done so far or anything? Yeah? Any questions?
No, you answered my question. It was just how we fared with the full committee on our draft. That's the only question I had that walked in the door.
Bruce, do you have anything?
No.
Okay, Mr. Pratt, it's yours.
Thank you, Senator Burns. First of all, before we get into the substance of this draft, I'll explain the format. Now, the first three sections that appear in your book, theft of services, criminal tampering, and a short section on misapplication of property, will fit into the area of related offenses to the basic theft statute that was presented to the full commission. The last sections that appear in your book, dealing with burglary and criminal trespass, obviously do not fit in either to theft or related offenses to theft, but they are crimes against property, and we can logically move on into these other areas now. Now, also in connection with this format, it, as you can see, is different from the approach we were taking in the
subcommittee earlier. I've set this up to correspond with the way we prepared our preliminary draft number 4 of our theft statute for the full commission, and that is setting out the proposed draft followed by a commentary showing a summary and the derivation of the section and its relationship to our existing law. And I thought perhaps we could just read through this aloud and go through a section with the commentary, preliminary to discussing the particular section. And I think if we do that, that we can perhaps answer some of the questions that you might have as we go along. If that's all right, Mr.
That's
Chairman,
fine.
I'll go ahead and start.
Yeah, through, start.
Everyone has their draft on theft of services, I think.
Okay, and I could suggest that if anyone has any questions as he goes along, just to raise them.
Sure. All right, now, theft of services, sub 1. A person commits theft if A, he obtains services which are available only for compensation by force, threat, deception, or other means to avoid payment for the services, or B, having control over labor in the employ of another person, or of business, commercial, or industrial equipment or facilities of another person, knowing that he is not entitled to the use thereof, and with intent to derive a commercial or other substantial benefit for himself or a third person, he uses or diverts to the use of himself or a third person such labor, equipment, or facilities as used in this article, or however we should designate this. Services includes, but is not limited to, labor, professional services, transportation, telephone service, the supplying of accommodations in hotels, restaurants, or elsewhere, entertainment, the supplying of equipment for use, and supplying of commodities of a public utility nature, such as gas, electricity, steam, and water. 3. Where compensation for services is ordinarily paid upon the rendering of them, as in the case of hotels, restaurants, and the like, absconding without payment or offered to pay is prima facie evidence that the services were obtained by deception. Now, services are not property, as we define it in our theft draft. And therefore, in order for theft of services to be covered, we must do it by a specific standard. Services, if he obtains services as defined in subsection 2, if the means defined in subsection 1A, or by diverting services under his control to which he is not entitled for his own gain, as prescribed by subsection 1B. Subsection 3, to aid in enforceability, provides that absconding without payment or an offer to pay is prima facie evidence of deception, if immediate payment is usually expected for the services obtained. For example, buy a meal, you're expected to pay for it. Or check out of a hotel, you pay your bill. Without such provision, the person who skips without paying for his accommodations would often be miles away from the scene before the law can act. Now, this is similar to, but not as broad as, the provisions contained in ORS 165230. Now, it's submitted that the instances that which an act needs to be considered as prima facie fraudulent are those where the actor has absconded. I think that there's good reason why we should limit this prima facie provision to these kinds of situations where it's necessary for law enforcement officials to act quickly. Somebody eats and runs, and it's difficult to make a case on him oftentimes without such provision, I think. Now, subsection 1A. Is based on the Model Penal Code, section 223.7. Now, I might mention that the blue sheets that appear in your books set out these sections. 223.7 is the first section that appears on numbered page 4 of the text and provisions of other states.
How does this affect the person who can't pay for his, can't pay his gas bill or light bill or
and take service, and then leaves back to his belongings and leaves
the immediate area.
You don't mean gas? I mean utilities.
I don't think this would apply in that type of situation. I don't think that's not the
issue. It isn't ordinarily paid for as it's obtained.
You pay your bill monthly, or...
But gas in an automobile would be different.
Right, you pull into a gas
station. Yeah.
And
certainly, that should
apply. You have some work done on your car, unless you made arrangements to pay for it otherwise. But I think, really, the type of situation that this is primarily designed to get at is you're defrauding an innkeeper type of situation, where you go into a restaurant or you skip out of your hotel.
That's fair enough. Just so it's written, so it does make that distinction. So.
Okay, referring to 223.7 on page 4 of the blue sheet, they say a person is guilty of theft if he purposely obtains services which he knows are available for compensation. Now, you've omitted the word he knows in 1A. You obtain services which are available on compensation. Would you not agree that, why did you omit that he knows?
Well, my thinking there, that...
It's hard to prove.
Yeah, it is hard to prove. And I think that if you have a situation where the services are available only for compensation, that proof that they are available only for compensation, so of course that's an element that wouldn't be difficult to prove in any case that I can see, but if you can show that they are available only for compensation, I think that you would certainly raise an inference. In any case, even with the other language in there, you would raise an inference that of knowledge on his part. I think that as the knowledge element in any crime, although it's a difficult item to prove, it's a difficult element to prove, I don't think you particularly accomplish
much by putting
it in.
Well, let me ask another question.
And you'll notice that
you put the same thing in mute. No, we should have known.
Yeah.
Right.
And I think that's implicit in there.
All right. What about the fact that we've omitted purposely here? Now, we're running a tandem again, so maybe the general articles are going to define criminal intent or whatever, but should we or should we not include willfully or purposely?
Well, as with these earlier drafts in other sections, I might, no pun intended, I purposely stayed away from words like purposely.
Because
I don't know how it's going to be defined, if at all. And although we have used in a number of places words of intent, I felt that as we go along here, that might be such language.
And we did that in our draft on the theft statute, didn't we? Okay. Well, good. One more question. we did and we didn't.
We have intent.
We put intent to defraud. Now, of course, it seems to me that intent to defraud is a... I guess we have intent here, don't we?
Well, there's another consideration here, too. As you refer back to our theft draft, some of the definitions that appear there. I think that as we look at sub 1A of our theft of services graph, to obtain services by force, threat, deception, or other means. I think implicit in that language is a willfulness. I think that it would be a strange interpretation of this language to say that this did not encompass an unlawful or a willfulness or a purpose to do what he did. And then too, I think that when the basic general articles are drafted, I certainly would be surprised to see any provision in there for making it criminal to negligently do something. I mean, I think it would be an unusual situation to have a negligent type of act as it relates to a theft statute.
Let's go ahead.
But I think that words of intent or words of purpose may to make this consistent with the overall substantive draft, in line with the commission's view about the general articles, as with the article on the comprehensive theft statute, that some changes may have to be made later to reflect and make it consistent throughout, make it consistent with the views of the commission with respect to words of intent or willfulness or purpose.
Well, we're closest, of course, on our theft of services, or close to the theft by deception part of the consolidated theft statute. And there, of course, we say, person obtains property from another, thereby commits theft by deception when with intent to defraud. And that apparently is the only section in our earlier work where we did use with intent to defraud. And of course, I noticed in the New York draft on page 4 of their statute, they break it down into three sections, one of which well, more than that, but seven sections. I think it's most important that the act be accompanied by willfulness and intent in order to be prescribed. And if the committee feels that it's implicit in the language, that's fine. I won't bring it up. So, go ahead, Don. That's all the only observation I have.
It's something that you should think carefully about, because in doing it, you want it so drafted that the intent is really there before you prosecute anybody on this. I know that people do just inadvertently walk out of restaurants and so on without paying. Done myself. But I always came back and paid them. That one I've recorded.
Well, not it.
So it's a difficult one. How's the old innkeeper law ordered on that?
Well, with intent
to defraud. Without intending to pay for them, obtained, didn't
you? Well, any person who is intended to fraud obtains food, lodgings, or other accommodations, etc., mm-hmm. etc. Et
well, that's been satisfactory.
I wanted to ask this, parenthetically. Is it intended that our defense section that we've already passed upon is going to be applicable to what we're doing now? The defenses. We have a section on defenses in the comprehensive theft statute, right?
Yes.
Are they going to be applicable to theft of services?
No.
And I'm wondering if possibly. No, I guess we're going to have to have a. Are we? They really wouldn't be, would they?
I don't think so, Mr. Chairman. I don't think that the type of situation where
decisions about attempt and fraud could be contained in defenses to theft of services.
Well, now, certainly it would not, be a major problem to insert the four pleadings in sub one of this draft, the word intentionally.
Seems to me that it isn't necessary where you get by force, threat, deception, or other means.
But I'll have to admit, I didn't think about the individual who just forgot to pay his bill and walked out. That type of thing.
Well, what is deception? I go to the Travel Lodge Motel in Eugene and stay all night, and instead of paying for my room in advance like I generally do, I forgot to, and I get up the next morning and I take off. And Medford and completely forgot. Now, and a week later, it was worn out by grass. The district attorney could construe my failure as an act of deception.
As a prima facie case here. Of course, he could have a prima facie case even with the word intentionally in there.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly. Intent would be a material part of the crime, and this would be a subject for instruction by the court. No doubt about it. It seems to me that maybe I'm picking.
What do you think, Captain? You think intentionally needs to be in there?
No, I didn't put the earlier one. Only the other situation I can think of that might come to that, and I think of force, possibly, and that's where you have your claim of right would be that you had a credit claim. You are therefore endeavoring to have any service rendered for which you feel you've already paid, and the person rendering the service doesn't feel that you paid for it. It's controversial in the facts. You would be, in a sense, feeling that you had a claim of right against the service they would feel that you were obtained, depending on whether it's the parking store or what, by force, trap, deception, or whatever. You sometimes have to kind of pound the table to get your credit in a lot of places. But I don't think intentionally would save that situation either. It's the same problem whether or not it would be the fact would support the
thing. Okay, maybe I'm splitting hairs. Did you have thought on that, Justice Long?
Well, the thing that was bothering me about it is this or other means. Without some indication that this must be a criminal intent or process or something, other means could be any kind of a process. Well, you forget it, or you trade for it, or there's nothing restricting that other means.
Now, that's the language that's in the Model Penal Code, and were there any cases?
Well, the Model Penal Code, you see, it's vague too, but they include that other means in or by false token or other means to avoid payment.
And the fact they don't use the second by there makes false token or other means within the category of false token.
Something false. Yes.
Because they use by deception or threat or by false token or other means. I think they've limited the meaning of other means there to something akin to the false token.
I think they have. I think it's modified by that.
Would this be solved if you just said the force, threat, deception, or other criminal means, or other unlawful means? And that you use that kind of a phrase someplace else, John?
Well, if you just use force, threat, deception, or instead of deception, with intent to defraud, couldn't you eliminate or other means, or this generalization?
Well, if you say force, threat, deception, or with intent to defraud, then are you excluding with intent to defraud as force, threat, or deception?
We looked at that earlier. If he was an intent to defraud, obtain services.
How's that?
He obtained services with intent to defraud. Jeremy, I don't know what the intent to defraud might help you compensate.
Well, he obtained services which were available only for compensation with intent to defraud or by force threat.
The horse didn't begin there. That's the wrong place for it. If with intent to defraud, he obtained services.
I think that solves the question that you raised with respect to other means.
Are you putting it after if or before the a?
We're putting it. Before the colon.
Now, how would that read now?
A person commits that if with intent to fraud, colon. Right?
And then that applies to all these.
And then the fraud, or intent to defraud, modifies the other means. So means it has to be valid with fraudulent means. Okay. Is Mr. Spaulding so moved the amendment?
I do.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion passed. Okay. Now,
do you think that using words with intent to defraud, do you think that's inconsistent with the language by force, for example?
No.
I suppose you could use force with intent to defraud.
Yes, you can have both means. Isn't it fraud if you hold up a guy? Force him to do something? It's two different things.
I think that, at least my conception of a fraudulent act is about 180 degrees from force. So
that's what I mean by two different things. Then.
John, does the phrase to avoid payment for the services relate to other means, or does it relate back to force, threat, or deception? The modified form.
Well, it was intended to modify the last just means.
That is.
And of course, the purpose of that was to avoid a limitation to the ones that were enumerated.
But then would you move your semicolon up after the word deception?
I agree with you that doesn't make sense to have both force and with intent to defraud.
Yeah, well, Kathleen, I think that either that or say a comma after deception. Would that make it clearer to put a comma?
Well, if maybe our problem is a person commits theft with intent to avoid payment for services, he obtains services which are available for compensation by force, threat, and deception. Would that help him? Maybe it's not an intention to defraud so much as his clear out and out intention is that he's trying to avoid payment.
Yeah,
by fraud or any other sneaky.
Well, that's right, and that's that's what I was trying to say there. If he obtained these services by one of these methods, either force or threat or deception or some other means designed to avoid anything.
Mm-hmm. So that's basically his intention. And that probably would get you out if the man inadvertently accidentally walks off without paying the ticket because he's not obtaining the services.
Yeah, he intends to pay for them, yeah.
Well, yeah. So in other words, we could say a person commits theft if with the intent to avoid payment for the services.
Other means with intent.
Oh, I see. Okay.
say that all together so we can...
After the word means or other means, the words with intent.
A person commits theft if he obtains services which are available only for compensation by force, threat, deception, or other means with intent to avoid payment for the service. Obtain these services by force, by threat, or by deception, which really is an attempt, or by other means, which means with intent to avoid. Well, I think that's better. So let's
withdraw my emotion.
Okay.
So I'm good.
Okay. How about that, Ed? Okay, so moved and passed. How about that, Don? I tried to slip one by you and I couldn't do it. I think that clears it up, doesn't it?
I'm not sure how you decided.
Well, we decided that after the word means, we insert with intent so that it reads, a person commits theft if he obtains services which are available only for compensation by force, threat, deception, or other means with intent to avoid payment for the services.
My problem is the same one I had a little bit before. With intent to avoid payment modifies which? Force, threat, deception, or only other means?
Other means.
Only the last one.
Well, I don't know. I think it should properly modify all of them.
Now,
in which case, while phrases maybe painting it on the tail end raises this question
of your
trouble.
Well, I'm just getting by force. Suppose you're going or arrested, intending to pay, and they're too slow, and you're going to take it away from them.
Well, or for example, you get into a taxi cab, and you force the cab driver to take you where you want to go.
Then you throw in a $5 bill.
Well, I don't think you'd have a crime then, Kathy, but most likely you'd
have
a
crime.
Threat or something like that. But,
what if you force him to take you someplace and then force him to take off his clothes? Like it happened before, but would that fall within this? No, I'd strike that. Strike that, Madam Secretary.
Well, that might be some other crime, but it wouldn't be largely of service.
I think Kathleen's right. I think that this should modify all these.
Yes. What?
The intent. The intent to avoid payment for the service.
Well, you
see, let's put it back up there after him.
You see, in the New York Penal Code section on page 4, they separate these in 7 different subsections, and I think the problem we're having because we're trying to lump it into one real comprehensive short statute. Now, could I ask? Michigan.
Michigan did pretty much the.
Pretty much like we did.
Yeah, like we did in the Model Penal Code.
And Michigan says intentionally obtain services, like the Model Penal Code says purposely obtain services. They also use a false token.
Well, I felt false token was redundant with deception.
Well, I think it is too.
Well, we can make that apply to all those things by putting it back up there after the word if. If with intent to avoid payment, therefore. And then strike it out at the end. Strike out the words to avoid payment for the service.
Bruce, when you do that, then when you read subsection B, it causes a little grammatical problem.
I wouldn't control it.
Yes, because he's not dealing with services at all where services isn't even used. But if you inserted it after the A,
I said if, with intent to avoid payment, therefore.
He obtained services, but to avoid paying it on the B, which makes a little.
And B already has a statement of intent.
Right, and it doesn't have to even use the word services, so.
Right. Yeah, that would make it more consistent, wouldn't it, with Michigan and New York put the with intent to avoid payment, put it out to the A.
Yeah.
The person commits that debt with intent to avoid payment, therefore, he obtains services which are available only for compensation by force, threat, deception, or other means. Semicolon?
No, semicolon after the means. I think I have a comma after the exception too.
Yeah. Let's try this one on for size and then go on to the next sub B, and we'll come back to this before we finally pass on it. And maybe you could appropriately amend your sub A. A person commits theft if colon A with intent to avoid payment, therefore, comma, he obtains services which are available only for compensation, comma, by force, comma, threat, comma, deception, comma, or other means, semicolon.
Or.
Now let's go on to B.
Our world. Yeah, okay, now. B is from section 16515 of the New York Code. And the reason I used that one rather than the Model Penal Code is I indicated in the commentary that it enumerates labor, equipment, and facilities rather than just merely calling them services. And I think better specifies what we're trying to do with this, and that is to prohibit the unlawful diversion of these things or facilities, tools and machinery and the use of labor to someone who isn't entitled to them.
Okay. Oh, yeah.
Now, an example of this would be, say, the individual who goes into, maybe he's a foreman or a worker in a plant, and he goes in after hours and uses the equipment to make something for his own personal need. Or he has control over a group of men on a construction project, and he diverts the paving crew out to his own house to lay a driveway down. He uses it for somebody else, a friend of his, or someone. That's why we have himself or a third person.
Is that just ordinary fraud?
See, these things aren't property. Strictly.
I'm the foreman for the paving crew. And I divert the paving crew out to my house, and they lay 100 foot of asphalt driveway. Okay. All right.
I could be guilty of theft of services in that I utilized the services of this paving crew unlawfully under this section, but I could also be guilty of plain old theft because of the misappropriation of the material, right? Now, do we run into a problem there, constitutional problem as far as the discretion of the district attorney?
No, I think the Perky situation is when it's describing, remember, exactly the same act as providing the possibility of two penalties attaching to it. Here you're really talking about
two separate.
Though they're intrinsically involved in your building and your nice driveway, they are two separate types of commodities or whatever that you're relating to and two separate aspects of the act. And it is possible, I suspect, in some cases where you would have somebody who might be guilty of taking the asphalt, but not the labor or the guy who uses the labor or heavy equipment kind of thing, where there is no commodity involved. So they are, they seem to be separable.
Okay. We don't have any parallel proscription in the Oregon Code.
Not for this type of thing. No, we don't.
This would really hit the longshoremen.
This is new, but it's an area that certainly has been covered not only by the Model Penal Code, but by all of the states that are getting into this type of revision and attempting to get at a problem which certainly wouldn't be covered under even a comprehensive theft statute unless you've got a definition of property that includes services.